Welcome back to our Open Source Startup Podcast. It's Tim from Essence BC and our lovely co-host, Robbie from Cowboy Ventures. Today we have Ben from Flagsmith, which is open source feature flag company, also an awesome podcast host himself. So welcome, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me. Yeah, great to be on the other side of the table.
Awesome. And we're thrilled to have you here. So we'd love to go all the way back to the beginning. Can you talk to us about the founding story for Flagsmith and where the idea for the company came from?
Yeah, sure. Well, the story starts 22 years ago because that's when I started a software agency with a good friend of mine in London. And a lot of the shape and design of Flagsmith as a company is based on the fact that it was initially a side project from that agency. So yeah, we started that company 22 years ago. It's still going. Agencies are kind of frustrating businesses. You've either got too much work or you've not got enough work. And when we had too much work, that was kind of like, great. But when we didn't have enough work, then we were always trying to figure out what we could, you know, spend our time hacking around and working on. And we, up until a few years ago, we just come up with stupid projects. So we built a massive LED wall with soldering guns. Everyone burns from soldering badly. And we wrote this software on an Arduino to run it. And it was really cool and fun. And then we built a riff on Instagram called Life is Terrible, where you were meant to send photos for when your life had like all gone wrong and the filters made the pictures look worse and things like that. And then, so we'd always play around, hack around with stuff when we didn't have paid work. And so the idea of Flagsmith came out of that. About 6 years ago, we started to put together a structure around coming up with ideas for projects that not necessarily could become legitimate standalone businesses, but just stuff that would, yeah, I don't know, like have some sort of longevity to them. And we put together a kind of a questionnaire, and anyone in the company could come up with ideas for side projects that we could run. And we had a kind of scoring criteria. And so we had like 6 or 7 ideas, and the agency still does do work with like large organizations, large engineering teams. So like hundreds of engineers working and trying to coordinate stuff. And one of the common problems we saw in these organizations was they just couldn't release software. Like it was really, really painful for them to release software. The most common pattern was, you know, they have a bi-weekly sprint. There's got like 6 teams that are meant to all have all of their stuff ready to deploy at the end of the second week. And they were all interconnected. And then one of the teams would not be able to deploy their software because there was some showstopper issue. So they'd punt the release, and then that would happen again and again and again. And then before you knew it, you've got like 3 months where there's no software and the CTO's freaking out. And that was the kind of the essence of, you know, like, well, we could use feature flags to do this. And at the time, there was really one entrant in the market, which is the one that everyone knows, LaunchDarkly. They still do, and they did at the time, had a really, really good product, but it was quite expensive. And we were like, well, there must be a note, you know, go on GitHub, open source feature flags. And there wasn't really anything there. There was a couple of projects, but they weren't how we would have designed them. And yeah, so that was the, you know, Kyle, one of the co-founders, he sat down and he filled in the form to say, we should build an open source feature flagging tool because A, it doesn't exist really. B, you could get something useful with a relatively short amount of time and development effort. And, you know, like we'd be our own customer. We know exactly what sort of things developers want. So it was by far and away, the score for that idea was like miles better than any of the other ideas that people had come up with. So that was the kind of genesis of things, was like, right, we're going to go and build a feature flagging platform. But we were doing it in our spare time. In the spare time of the engineering team at the agency. So it took a long time to get to the point where we were sort of proud enough to push it onto GitHub. And then the velocity of the platform was pretty slow because if we had more work come in from people who were going to pay us, then that would always take priority.
Yeah, it's actually really fascinating. There's quite a few different founder journeys getting into an open source based company. And it sounds like I was consulting, I learned a lot of lessons, and I started a company throughout that project. I always noticed that there are some pros and cons for that. So I want to maybe talk about sort of that transition, because I'm pretty intrigued about that usually. What is sort of like the hardest things you have to unlearn, you know, getting out from consulting for 2 decades? Because you saw the problem, right? You work on the project. So you definitely understand what needs to be done on a per client, per project basis. And obviously you probably evaluated LaunchDarkly, some other solutions, and found what is useful for you. But when it turns to a project and a company behind it, that isn't a very natural transition for most people. So the probably things you have to relearn or unlearn to accelerate. You touched on maybe some blog posts, but what do you hear me talk about? Like, what are the biggest learnings you had?
I think the most obvious one is that when you're working at an agency, the feedback loop is very, very, very short, right? Like the sales cycle for us, it's a small agency. So a relatively large client would be like £500,000 a year in revenue kind of thing, maybe a bit more. And, but you know, from someone contacting you and saying, can you build me this thing? Or can you transform this platform into AWS, whatever, you know, that's like weeks. And then you start working and, you know, you're working with these people and you know, the feedback loop and the sort of everything moves quite quickly. And then I think the longest projects we've ever worked on as an agency was like over like 2.5 years, but that was very unusual. Like normally, I don't know, you spend like 4 months working on something and then, you know, you hand it over to an internal team or initial team or whatever. The thing that is most different now in my life, because I work on Flagsmith full time, is you just constantly pushing the stone up the hill, right? Like a little bit at a time, a little bit at a time, year after year after year, you know, and that progress accumulates very, very, very gradually. And, you know, the work that you put in, I don't know, like refactoring the documentation like 4 years ago, you know, you're like, okay, now that makes the project and the platform a tiny little bit better and a tiny little bit better. And it's very unusual. Like we've had a couple of releases that we've like put a massive like advance in the platform, right? Like we released an edge network. We totally refactored every SDK that we, you know, but it's very, very unusual. Normally you're making these tiny little incremental improvements and you don't get any feedback from them at all. So, or it's very unusual to get feedback from them directly, right? Like, you know, some little pull request where you fix something or some like very, very sort of incremental improvement. Like no one's like, oh, wow, you know, pull request 1312 was great. Like, no, that's the most difficult thing, is like you're moving in this sort of very murky world and you're never quite sure if you're moving forwards or not. And because we didn't raise money and because we didn't kind of like have this sudden, you know, if we'd have gone out and raised a bunch of money, that would have had like a fundamental shift in the business. And, you know, we would have had, I don't know, hired people and they could have spoken to customers and done marketing and got feedback from people. But we didn't do that. So we spent years just like, yeah, like you're kind of, I don't know, the analogy I've got in my head is like you're on a boat and it's like there's just mist everywhere and you just don't know, are we moving? Is anything happening? And so, yeah, that's been the kind of biggest thing that I've had to kind of come to terms with. Like, because if you're an agency, like you spend time working on and then people pay you, right? Whereas, you know, with a product that you've been working on for several years, yeah, you just, I've found it impossible to shake off that feeling of like, and it is like our revenue's going up really well. Like we're growing as a business. You know, 2 years ago, there was 2 of us and now there's 10, right? So objectively, that's working. But yeah, I still have that kind of like, I don't know, whether it's imposter syndrome or just like, you know, like racked with like, are we moving at all? You know, even though there's like hard data that we are, yeah.
So I want to talk a bit about the open source piece and why that's important for a feature flagging tool. Because for applications where there isn't an open source alternative and then there becomes one, it usually means that it's targeting engineers. But in the case of feature flags, you also have users who are in product and who are in marketing. So can you talk a bit about the user persona for Flagsmith and also how you kind of thought about targeting, I assume, in this case, developers, engineers, but then also having an open source product that will encompass the other folks at an organization who would also be using feature flags?
It's interesting. So, I mean, Flagsmith in the position that it has in the market is very much, and we've moved more in this direction. And, you know, we've got our quadrant and we're moving more into the corner, which is A, open source, and B, we're built for engineers, right? So the product category is quite interesting because you've got like folk like Split or Statsig, who are very much more about experimentation, and they're sort of very much more about like product teams and product development. You've got us, where we made a very conscious early decision not to do ingest behavioral data, right? Like, we're not trying to do that. We wouldn't be any good at it. Amplitude's amazing. Adobe's amazing. Mixpanel's amazing. Send the data there. We're focused very much on engineers. And that's because, you know, when we started, we're engineers. We built the platform that we wanted. Yeah. And initially, right, I mean, it's still to this day, like, the decision-making process with the people who we're selling to, we sell very much from a bottom-up point of view. So their engineering leads, I don't know, technical project managers or whatever, are generally in like a large organization. And we're not selling to the CTO or the CIO and then them going, you know, it should be great. They go, right, like, you know, there's 20,000 engineers and we're all going to use this platform, which should be great. But no, we're very much more like from a bottom-up point of view. And that's the other interesting thing, is we never, ever, ever had any discussions at all about whether it should be open or not. That was, no one ever talked about it. It was completely implicit and obvious. And like, it was just a completely natural thing to do. And we never were like, oh, should we be open or closed? Because part of the reason that the project exists is because we wanted it to exist in GitHub. And then also, you know, we were so, myself and some of the other founders were just so inspired by, you know, the standard roster of names of, you know, like HashiCorp and GitLab and Sentry and all of these projects who still do have amazingly valuable open source versions of their product that exist. And it turns out that there are some really, 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 like, the business is growing fundamentally because the platform is open, but not for the reasons you might think. And we didn't think, and we hadn't ever thought about these things when we open sourced it. That's kind of a fortuitous situation. So to give you an example, one of the things that was implicit in the design of the platform on account of it being open was we want anyone to be able to run it, right? Like, if you're on a laptop, on a plane, you should be able to run Flagsmith. If you're deploying it to a huge Kubernetes cluster with, you know, incredibly hardcore performance requirements, it needs to be relevant to those guys and everything in between. And as a result of that, we built the platform on very simple, sort of primitive bits of infrastructure that anyone can run. You know, we're not tied to any cloud provider and we're not using any weird components or tooling infrastructure. It's very, 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 it's a database and an API. And that turned out to be really, really, really helpful because our main customers are running the platform on premise. And so, you know, if we'd have started building it using Amazon stuff or Google Cloud stuff or whatever, we wouldn't have those customers as customers, because we're at the point, you know, the conversation would go, you need to run it on Amazon. And they're like, we can't run it on Amazon. And that would be the end of the conversation. So the shape of the business is very much like that because the platform is open. And I'd love to take the credit for being like, you know, this was very obvious to me very early on, but it wasn't. It just so happens to be that way, yeah.
So I want to kind of hone down into like the initial way you focus on what kind of users and how you focus on them. Like, because, you know, initially, I think LaunchDarkly definitely is like the most known entity. I think you focusing on being open source and now looking how you compare LaunchDarkly and you, right? You're focusing a lot on on-premise, like the flexibility on the pricing. So that side seems to be the original, that is your way of getting into the market. Is that how you started initially? Like, this is actually,
no,
we believe, no, what is the right way to talk to our users for us. So what, I'm curious, like, how do you start? Where do you start focusing on what can the users really hone down to?
So the probably the biggest mistake we made early on, I mean, and it's kind of weird as well, because I don't kind of beat myself up about it too much because it was a side project, right? Like we weren't like, right, you know, in a year we're going to spin off this company and raise money and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, and then buy boats in 10 years and all this sort of stuff like that. It was literally a side project, but we should have, and we didn't think long and hard enough about who the target customer was. And the crazy thing was we kind of knew who the target customer was, right? Because it was the companies that we were consulting to, right? They were the ones that gave us the idea. They were the ones that we were like, this would be super valuable for these guys because they've got a room in London in an office with 300 engineers in it and they can't deploy their software and it's costing them a fortune, you know. So we knew who those target customers were. It was staring us in the face, but we didn't go and speak to them really. What we did was we were like, well, how did GitLab monetize their platform, right? Well, they set up, you know, a paid version of the platform and let people subscribe to that. So that's what we did. And at the time we thought, well, so there's two things about hosting a feature flagging platform. There's pretty strong requirements around latency and uptime, right? Like you really don't want your feature flagging platform to go down. And so we thought, well, we can make an open source version, but people will want to pay for us to build a really reliable, resilient, low latency infrastructure, because that's kind of hard. No, it's not hard, but it's like, if you're running it yourselves and, you know, it goes down, there's a lot of problems around that. So we were like, well, you probably want to offload that and you'd probably want to, it seemed obvious and we didn't put enough thought into it. So the first thing we did was we put out, built a website, allowed people to subscribe for a plan, made it a lot cheaper than LaunchDarkly was at the time. And, you know, thought, we'll just do that. And again, at this point, it was still a completely side project. Like we weren't expecting to have any sort of significant revenue. And it it took like quite a long time. You know, we started getting a slow sort of like trickle of subscriptions, but it wasn't really growing that quickly. And it was only when we sat down and were like, who is our target customer? Because what happened was we started to get inbound requests. And we had a really very, very primitive website, not a very like active open source repository or community, but we were getting a steady flow of emails from huge organizations saying, can I buy an enterprise license? And we were like, how much would they want to pay for an enterprise license? We had no idea how much they would want to pay for an enterprise license. So that was kind of where we found ourselves. Yeah.
It's super interesting. And it's really helpful hearing the signals that you looked for to say, okay, there really is a there. Like this should now go from being a side project to a full-on company. I'm interested in what, because you've built out such great content, like you have a podcast, you have some like great blogs, like what worked as far as trying to fuel the community growth? And like, what were some of the things that you learned? Just because to your analogy before, the like boat that's going through a bunch of mist, you have no idea where you're going. I feel like that's where a lot of open source founders feel early on, even with their community, where they sometimes don't know what's going to help grow it. And they'll all kind of point to like content and developer relations, but it's hard to know like what will hit and what won't. So are there any learnings for you on that front that you think would be helpful for others to hear?
Well, the thing, they might not want to hear this, but the thing that was probably the most important for us was time. Like we weren't in a rush, right? It was a side project. We were using it. Other people were using it. We had a few people contribute. Like I think early on we had some contributions that were really, really quite significant. But the thing that we had on our side was time. There wasn't a runway. The clock wasn't ticking. There wasn't a board meeting every quarter with people banging this drum going like, you know, why haven't you grown five times faster and blah, 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 blah. So I guess that might not be the answer that people want to hear because like, but you know, the thing that we found is, with time you get, there's a bunch of stuff that come out of that. Firstly, like generally open source projects grow organically. They have like a natural cadence of growth that we found very difficult to alter the rate of, right? And we're kind of fine with that. You know, our stars accumulate at a almost perfectly linear rate. And so, yeah, like we put out, I don't know, like content that we thought people would, you know, that we'd want to read about. So like engineering stuff, like quite technical things. And then like a little bit more recently talking about like the internals of the business and building out, you know, API that now has a fairly significant amount of traffic and all that sort of stuff, because they, you know, that's just what I, you know, I'd love to know. So, you know, companies, and they're always kind of like a little bit secret about like, oh, you know, like, how do we serve our requests and what does our platform look like? And it's kind of secret sauce. But for us, it's not really, because it's all open anyway, right? So, well, most of it. So people can see that as it is. So in the early days, we just pushed out content that we would want to hear, but there wasn't, it was fairly sort of haphazard and sort of chaotic, because there wasn't, you know, it was only just before COVID came into existence that anyone was working on it full time. It was only, I think it was like around about the winter before COVID that the MRR of the business wasn't enough to support me. But again, like the thing that we kept falling back on that's been so, you know, it's kind of a superpower really is the agency, right? Like the agency was the thing that gave it time. The agency was the thing that gave it free engineering resource. And then, you know, when we got to, I can't remember, it was probably like 40 or 50K in ARR. At that point, I said to Matt, the guy that I started the agency with, like, look, I'm going to go and work on this full time and see, let's give it 6 months and, you know, see if it's working basically. Yeah.
So looking at your star history, obviously there is a linear growth and then it spiked. Spiked around June 2021.
Yeah. So we basically like fired all our bullets in one go. So what happened with the business was I was the only person like employed by Flagsmith basically. There was still engineering stuff going on to help from the agency. But when COVID started, I got introduced to three guys who'd had successful careers in the Valley doing go-to-market for enterprise B2B sales, basically. And that was absolutely one of those, like, the moment after the first meeting we had with them, we were both like, this is absolutely perfect, right? Like, we're completely perfect for each other. We're really terrible at organizing ourselves around go-to-market. We don't know how much enterprises want to pay for this stuff or what they'll pay for it. And the sales cycle is noise sort of stuff. And this was things that Matt and Greg and Alex, who came on board working on the project, brought. So that was something that really kicked up the growth rate of the business. But then we got a marketing person to join the team, and we had like, we'd never posted on anywhere on like Reddit or anything like this. And we had all this kind of interesting stuff to talk about. So we basically like, you know, we had all this stuff stored up that we hadn't kind of like sprayed all over social, you know, Reddit or Hacker News or whatever. And so we just went and unloaded it in the period of like 2 or 3 months. And we had this like big rate of increase in a like all of the metrics that we care about. So the amount of visitors to our GitHub repository and the amount of stars and contributors and all this sort of stuff. So yeah, like that was just, we just, you know, because at the time it was like, no one was really interested in doing that. So it didn't get done. Keep coming back to this idea that, you know, it was side projects and it was, if someone didn't want to do something, then it didn't happen, right?
Yeah. And I often find like a lot of early, especially very early founders working open source, especially also your open source project isn't that well known or just getting started or whatever. There is always an idea, I want to find either evangelist or a marketing person to help me push even further, right? They may or may not have done that much open source community growth before. And I found there are so many different approaches across different companies, right? We talked to Hugging Face, like no evangelist, no marketing, everybody has to be one, right? I think there's definitely a role having marketing involved, but it's not going to be your typical product marketing. It's not going to be typical VP of marketing, right? It's none of that, right? So how did you learn what is the right marketing help you need? And how did you figure out how to work together? Because I think the marketing person isn't writing the content, right? Your product or a team is writing the content. So the marketing is helping to think about how to grow this, but not many marketing people also grew an open source community at all. And so like, just think about how did you find the right person and how do you figure out how to work effectively together so that it's actually seeing the results you want?
Yeah. I mean, and that's something that I don't think you ever really know if you've got it right. Right. Like, so there's a number of reasons for that. Like, yeah, so you're right. Like the content is either technical or, you know, you need someone who knows how to write a mobile application, understands what Amplitude is and how to drive a multivariate test with it and get the result. You know what I mean? That's like five roles in a company, right? Or in a team. And so that's been really challenging finding, and we find people who can help do that. Like, you know, like someone who's expert in Go and understands what the subtleties are around using feature flags in Go for, you know, whatever reason, because the language paradigms are different, blah, 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 blah. And again, like the thing that probably worked for us best was just being able to just seed out this content that then gets on that long tail Google, you know, so if you search for Golang feature flags or something like that, like, you know, just making sure that we had as much of the, I mean, that's not quite long tail, but, you know, like the thing, like specific things that people are searching for, right? And then just going, right, you know, what's the most obvious one to, you know, what's going to get the most traffic? JavaScript feature flags, right? So write that. And then what's the next mode, right? I don't know. And then we start doing like even more, but, you know, like Next.js feature flags or whatever. So it was very much around natural search. Like, and again, like that was out of necessity because no one had given us $10 million for us to give like three straight to Google, right? We didn't have any money to do that. So we haven't done it. So we had to figure out a strategy that worked for us that didn't involve giving like millions of dollars to Google to have, you know, join the bun fight of like the five feature flagging companies that have bought the first page of Google. And we're on, you know, even though like we're number, I think last time I checked, we were open source feature flags. We were the number one result, right? And we're still like halfway down the second page. But that's something that really annoys me about. I'm going to start ranting about Google's product design. But yeah, so a lot of it was informed by not having money and just having time as well, right? So like we couldn't do, you know, I don't know, like KubeCon booths or whatever it might be. We had people's time and we just had to work to that angle, really.
And I actually just validated. You are, in fact, the the first result of right after all the sponsored ones. And I think
yeah, how far did you have to scroll down? Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's funny because there are quite a few sponsored ones, but it really does speak to the power of content and just the power of getting your name out there in an organic way. I also think it's super timely because we have so many startups right now that are kind of shifting their mindset or needing to shift their mindset from spend, growth, shift out of necessity into more the way that you've been building and being more patient, being more in control of your own destiny. So I wonder if there are some learnings around how you balanced thinking about investing in growth and doing it in a timely way where you can really take advantage of the momentum that Flagsmith was building while also like being in control of your own destiny. And I believe you raised in 2020, so a couple of years after you started. So how that decision came about and just like some of your ethos on how to balance like the growth versus being super efficient.
So Matt and Greg and Alex, the guys that I talked about who taught us what go-to-market was, we did this kind of unusual deal with them where they invested a relatively small amount of money, like, you know, in the Valley, it would like not even register in terms of like, you know, it was like very, very low six figures. But then they came on board and they said, right, when we get to 30K MRR, then so we'll do an equity for cash thing, very normal. And then we'll work on the business with you and we'll get it to 30K MRR and that will unlock the second part of our equity. And then they worked on the platform on the business, you know, and they still do work on it, although not as much. But that was the thing that really accelerated the growth of the business and started this engine of on-premise enterprise deployments and then learning more about what those sorts of customers wanted and where we were deficient and then building those out and then learning more. And then, you know, and then you get this like positive flywheel. I mean, other than like pricing is impossible, right? Like pricing is one of those things you can't ever be right. And you never know whether you're even near, right? Like it's so frustrating. And then the balance of the team is again, like it's something that you're never quite sure, you know, like, yeah, if we've got 10 people, should we have four engineers or eight or seven or, you know, so some of that was informed by Matt and Greg and Alex Polychrome, like in terms of the shape of businesses that they'd worked at and they'd worked at, you know, very, very successful hyper growth companies. Which, you know, like maybe the ratio of what sort of person is working in those companies is completely wrong for Flagsmith at the time. So it's kind of one of those things that it's like, I just kind of have a feel, or we have a feel for whether the team feels balanced or not. Yeah, like it's just a kind of like instinct of like, it doesn't feel balanced, right? So there's no structure around those things at all. It's like, doesn't feel like it's quite balanced, right? You know, or it didn't. Right now, I feel like we're right. Also, especially like, you know, when you're going from like, you know, I don't know, like 2 to 3 people, that's like a huge shift in the company's makeup, right? Like when you go like, you know, to hiring like the first full-time salesperson, like, yeah, that's like a fundamental, you know, that's a huge change in the business. So we've kept the team small, partly out of necessity, but also like just because we don't want to start going crazy and going down that road. So, and everyone's going to have an opinion on it and no one's able to say whether they're right or not, right?
So I kind of want to like fast forward and talk about like your latest milestones. I saw you have a blog post celebrating 1 million ARR, right? You talk about like the learnings there. And I think we already touched on some of them in our episode, but I'm curious, like, how did you continue to find your customers choosing you? Because I think back then was open source Flagsmith, right? There's LaunchDarkly, and now there's like 7 open source feature flag companies out there. So if it's just using open source or some level of that, you may not be able to actually tell quite easily the difference, right? So that have to go down to nuances. And how did you hone down on able to continue to hone down your positioning? And what were sort of like the key learnings growing from this early revenue towards, okay, now we have the repeatability to get to like what our 1 million ARR. Is it team dynamics changes or is there any particular go-to-market differences as well?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it was a bit self-fulfilling in a way because the thread that runs through all of these things is like we're engineers building for engineering teams. And we decided that was the strategy. We weren't going to build a behavioral analytics thing. Like we made that strategic call very, very early on. And so we carried on designing the product and designing the content and the marketing around it and the team around that. And then we were selling to those folk in larger organizations. That was successful, you know, and so that's this kind of, you know, and then you learn more about what those sorts of team, you know, do they care about, I don't know, like OpenShift or Kubernetes, or do they need Terraform scripts for AWS, blah, 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 blah. And so, you know, we were just relentless about just repeating that. And the addressable market, which is obviously, you know, why guys like yourselves really into developer tooling, is insanely large, right? Like it's just insane and growing all the time. And so we're carving out that kind of bit, you know, and then, yeah, like just learning more about what they want. And, you know, just, I mean, I was talking about this the other day, like every time we had to answer a sales question with, no, we don't have that feature, or no, we don't support blah or whatever, we'd make a note of it in a spreadsheet. And then every time we heard the question asked again, we had to say, no, we just add one to the tally. And that was our basically, not entirely, but that's been a large part of our product roadmap for the last 3 years. And if you carry on doing that, you start having sales calls. You know, I remember quite clearly, actually, like a couple of years ago, like we had a sales call with a pretty big company, pretty like full on set of requirements. And like we'd said yes to everything. And I got off the call and I'm like, you know, all right, if we don't win that, we don't win it, because you don't win them all. But, you know, massively patted myself on the back because like, we did everything that they wanted, right? We had the IDP integration and we had the blah and the webhook for this and the SOC 2 complete. Everything was like, yes. So that's been a large part of it. And then also, this is something that we talk about a lot as well internally, which is like, what percentage of engineering teams are either using feature flags or know what they are conceptually and are considering them, right? Like, I still think that that number is very, very low. And so, you know, not only is the addressable market growing in terms of like, you know, software is eating the world, blah, 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 but also as a sort of pattern for building software in terms of like the mind share of engineering teams, that's growing as well. And so we're definitely in a very much like, you know, rising tide lifts all the boats. And there's obviously like one massive boat, too many ship analogies, but yeah, like, you know, so we're just kind of like, we understand who our customer is. We've been relentlessly working on polishing the platform and the experience. And like, you know, because it's not just, especially when you're running, selling on-premise software, it's not just like, yeah, feature, feature, feature. It's like, what's the deployment experience like? What's the scaling experience like? How easy is it to load test it? You know, what's the security policy and stance and all this sort of stuff? A lot of non-functional stuff, which is kind of frustrating in a way, because it's like, you know, you can't come on podcasts or blog about like, you know, we've just got this amazing new feature where you can do blah. But yeah, it's very much around like just polishing the platform and being able to sort of answer yes as often as you can when you're trying to sell it.
Awesome. And I think the thing that we love to end on, and you've shared so many nuggets of advice for other open source founders, but what are some of the things that you wish someone told you when you were earlier on in your journey that you'd want to share with other open source founders?
I mean, the classic one really, which is like, you need to not be scared of like asking people, you know, doing more customer development early on, really. Like I said, it was kind of staring us in the face, but we were just classic engineer mindset. Like, just if you're not in front of a developer environment, then what are you doing kind of thing? Which was definitely like the classic mistake that we made, I think. Yeah. Like that. I mean, that's probably the most important. And then, yeah, I guess just understanding that time is like a really important function, and not kind of freaking out that, yeah, like sort of letting go of those feedback loops that you feel like you need to be able to not stress about things not immediately hitting, right? Like, because so much of this stuff is like a compounding effect of like, now your documentation's a little bit better, and now your Kubernetes experience is a little bit nicer, and now the Rust SDK is a little bit blah, 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 you know. And it's like these like very, very small compounding things that eventually get you to a point. But yeah, like it took me a long time to kind of let go of that, which is kind of crazy as well, because we didn't have a runway, right? Like we've always like basically had a profitable business. That's the decision that we made to a very early stage. So even then, you know, we should be the last people who are like freaking out about like, you know, but yeah, like it was still hard to let go of that and just to sort of step back and look at the thing as a whole and see that there is a cumulative build of stuff that happens. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, this has been a fantastic episode. Thank you so much for doing this with us, Ben. I think our listeners are going to learn a lot.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks for having me.